All right, this is episode 44 of the Gone Rogue podcast. I just said, what episode is this? And Greg said, 69, giggity, which it is not. We're at 44. We also thought that maybe we would actually have intro music for the first time. If anybody is in a public space right now, I highly recommend... that you do not have your sound high. If you're with your family right now, please turn the podcast off. But we're just going to throw out some ideas for our little intro music. This is one of them.
Might get flagged.
There's one. There was one part of that video that was like the balls slapping.
So before we started the podcast, Kate was just scrolling through Reddit to see if there was something she wanted to talk about. And somehow, mysteriously, some porn came up in her Reddit feed, which she always seems very surprised about how it got there.
But... I have no idea how it got there. Hey, also, we're recording this as a video. So if you want to watch us on video, we're actually recording it where you can see us. We are in the same house, but in different rooms. So we've got podcast recording equipment, but we ended up setting it up. So one's in Greg's office and one is in mine. So if you want to watch us talking, you can watch us talking. We're going to talk a little bit about Freud and jealousy. I found this section of a book. It's called The Jealousy Workbook by Kathy Labriola. I actually talk about it in another podcast episode that's coming up at the end of January. Look at me. I've gotten ahead on a few episodes. We've got a couple of interviews coming up. I've already pre-recorded an episode for a quickie episode on jealousy for the end of the month, end of next month. And I managed to get Greg on for an episode, which in the last episode I said I would do, and here we are. It only took the Christmas holidays and a Saturday for us to actually make it happen. So Freud's jealousy nightmare scenario. So he described what he called the four major components of jealousy, a nightmarish combination of experiences that he believed occurred sequentially. Number one, first, we experience grief, the terrible pain of actually losing or being afraid of losing someone we love. Two, next, we are flooded with the very distressing realization that we cannot have everything we want in life and that we may lose our precious relationship or some valued component of the relationship. Three, then we are gripped with feelings of enmity towards the successful rival who has won the love of our partner or who we fear will succeed in stealing our partner. And four, last, we turn our anger on ourselves in a belief that our own inadequacies as a partner will cause our partner to leave us. We fear that we are inferior to a rival and that we will lose our lover and that we deserve to be abandoned for a better partner. So jealousy is this expression of, you know, all of our worst fears, loss, grief, deprivation, rejection, humiliation, and abandonment. And it confirms all of our insecurities about our own inadequacies as a partner and this idea that we don't deserve to be loved. So looking at these four aspects, what she talks about is how you might score in these different areas. So she goes on to explain an exercise where you rate each component. So there's grief and loss, there's fear and sadness, there's hostile feelings, and there's anger towards yourself. And then you evaluate the accuracy. This is the part that actually got interesting. But before we move on, with those four areas, do you resonate with any of them in terms of feeling jealousy or feeling negative emotions in non-monogamy or in relationships in general?
So is his theory that they all, you know, jealousy is a result of all of those things happening at the same time, or are they the different areas
sequentially
that jealousy can occur?
Sequentially. So he talks about jealousy having all four things come up, and it's one after another. So there's grief, there's this realization you can't have everything you want. Then there's the animosity or hostile feelings towards the other person, and there's anger within yourself. So he walks through it as like, you know, the whole experience just being torture. But what this exercise in the book does is it actually tries to highlight if there's maybe just one of those areas that stands out for you, or maybe two of them. Do you feel like you have an area that hits home with thinking through those those four parts of jealousy that he describes?
Out of all of those, I think, just thinking through, like, I think the last one, the sort of, I suppose, you know, feelings towards yourself is probably the one that I've gone through the most. I think with the first two, you know, that sort of grief and fear of loss and, you know, the, I forget the exact wording, but yeah, the first two, I suppose, around like loss of, you know, you, I think there's some of the parts where I feel like it definitely scares me, the thought of losing you, but I think there's also a degree of like coming into this that I was, maybe like, you know, my almost my starting position for relationships is it's probably not going to work out. Like, I think I'm pretty skeptical in general about the long-term sustainability of relationships in general. So I think with that as my starting point, almost that's where I think I view non-monogamy as almost like, not what have you got to lose, but almost like an antidote to what I think is already the inevitable in a way. So I think that's why when I sort of found non-monogamy, it was coming in thinking like, well, shit, like relationships don't work out in the long term for, you know, I don't know, I'll throw it and say 9 out of 10 people that I know, right? Like, so it's like, well, what can you do to almost improve those chances of not being the one of the 9 out of 10 that don't work out? So I think non-monogamy was the sort of, okay, well, like, you know, if that's the antidote to some of the long-term like mismatch in desires, mismatch, like, you know, all of those things that people kind of go through, I think that's what sort of felt like maybe the antidote to some of those first ones. So they come up less for me. Although obviously, yeah, like I said, the fear of losing you is probably the, you know, the biggest thing, right? But it's like, if I come in with that presupposition of like, that would happen in a long-term relationship anyway, like that's sort of almost inevitable. Yeah, I don't know if that makes sense. So yeah, I think I've never really resonated like during this with the feelings towards someone else, and I think I actually have generally a reaction to using the word jealousy. It's the question that people always ask is, oh, don't you feel jealous, or don't you get jealous? And I've always related that word, particularly since we've been doing this, as something I'm facing towards the other person that you're interested in. And I think I've had it in my awareness from very early on that it's actually more about me than it is about the other person. So I don't, out of all of them, that's probably the least one, is that sort of feelings towards someone else. I think that's only come up for me once in our relationship, where I actually felt, you know, some kind of negative emotion towards someone you've seen. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. I read through this and was like, bing, 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 all of them. I was like, oh my God, this is me. But then what was good is step two of the exercise is, after you've kind of rated each component on a scale, you evaluate the accuracy of your ratings. So essentially it's like, you could feel like one of them is a really significant thing, but when you assess it and you break it down, you're like, you know what, I've kind of realized that this is actually not a deep belief that I have. So the example that she gives is,
before you jump into that, talk through how, you know, those four resonate with you. Like, you know, I know you said that you, like, they all went off for you kind of thing, but anything you want to share on specifically on those four areas?
Yeah, I think the so it says, first we experienced grief, which is the pain of losing or being afraid of losing someone. I definitely early on probably had that fear of feeling like I was going to lose you, and maybe that still plays into it, but it doesn't feel like those are the specific words that plague my mind if I'm worried or feeling scared. But I do feel like maybe some of it is underpinning some of my experience, and it feels like it's on a very, you know, primal level, where it's like, it's just a fear and sometimes I can't explain it. And I think that that's probably got something to do with it. But I would say that I would probably mark that low. You know, if we're going to rate these as a scale of 1 to 10, it's like one of the things says, how large a part does this component play in your jealousy? And I'd probably put it like 4 or below. And then it says, how painful and debilitating is this component of your jealousy? And again, it'd probably be like a 3 or below. Then fear and sadness that we may not be able to have everything we want in this relationship and that we cannot control the situation. I think, like you said, if I reflect that on myself, like, I can't be everything that you need, then that's probably where that would come up for me. But I think that's more at the end, like the anger towards yourself thing. So I think like the idea that we may not be able to have everything we want, the way that that shows up for me is probably, I talk about it as my monogamy brain. Like I get very like, oh, well, I'm not the one, and like you, I'm not enough for you. And those kinds of things can come up for me. So maybe that's like the fear and the sadness of me not being able to be enough for you. But again, it feels like that falls into that final category of the inadequacy thing. Hostile feelings towards your rival, the person who is having a relationship with your partner and who you feel will steal your beloved away from you. It's funny, I would mark that super low, even though I've certainly gotten wound up about people that you've seen. And I'm very good at comparing myself, especially with like how someone looks to how I look. But I think the idea that like someone will steal you away from me, I don't know if I even believe that. I think if you're stealable, then that's because you're not invested in this relationship and you don't want to be here. So I don't even think the idea of someone being able to steal you away makes sense to my brain. I'm like, look, if you can be stolen, then you probably don't want to be in this relationship in the first place. Yeah. The final one, you wanted to say something?
No, like I think that's one of the things that people will always ask, like on dating apps, it's do you get jealous and aren't you scared that they'll fall in love with someone else? You know, is the general theme, if anyone, their first questions that don't really know anything about this kind of relationship. And that second piece particularly is the thing I've always been like the least worried about, as far as like, I don't think the chances of, you know, you just meeting someone else and spontaneously falling in love with them to some degree more than what you feel with me, I just think that's almost a, you know, 0% chance. And I see it in the same way around. Like, I know that there's no one that I'm going to meet, you know, that I'll just go, oh wow, I love you more than I love Kate. Like, you know, it's just, I don't see those things as any kind of possibility for me or our relationship, because I have a lot of faith in the relationship, I think.
Yeah, you do. You're blushing. Okay, finally, let's get to the good stuff. Anger towards yourself for your perceived inadequacies as a partner and a belief that your rival is in fact superior to you, so that you deserve to be abandoned for this other person. See, that just, I feel like there's so much of those other three areas that are wrapped up into that. So perceiving yourself as inadequate in general as a partner, as well as in comparison to the other person, fear of abandonment, feeling someone's better than you, feeling like you're not enough for your partner, that is a high rating for me. So how large a part does this component play in your jealousy? Easily 8 or above. How painful and debilitating is this component of your jealousy? When I'm struggling with it, probably 8 and above again. That's where I feel like I struggle the most, when I'm not dealing well with things. And you and I have talked about, sometimes it's fine. Like, you had a date last night and it was fine. It was totally okay. But there have been dates that haven't even been hookups. It's just been a coffee date and you're gone for a little bit longer than I thought you'd be gone. And it's like the whole world might as well be on fire. So that one's the thing. That one's definitely the one that strikes home for me. And I think that is, you know, we've always talked about jealousy being just an expression of insecurities or having a very tight relationship to insecurities. And I think that for sure is what it is for me, just insecurities, comparison, feeling like I'm not enough. And the real heart of that is just that fear of insecurity, I think, is the big one for me. You know, I think people have like a fear of abandonment, a fear of being inadequate, a fear of, what did I say before? Fear of security, a fear of being inadequate. Inadequacy. So yeah, I think that's the big one for me. But the example of trying to evaluate the accuracy of your ratings, And what was interesting for me is even walking through this now, when I actually flesh it out a little bit, I kind of go, you know what? Some of those other ones, they don't, when you put them right next to each other, yes, there's probably an element of each one that I deal with at different times, and maybe sometimes together or sequentially, like it's kind of spoken about here. But when you look at them side by side, I'm like, oh no, this is the one that sticks out for me for sure compared to the other ones. Those other ones are definitely lower on the charts. So it's kind of good to do that, because I when I read the first explanation of each of the four things, I was like, oh man, all of those make sense to me. I'm struggling, and like there's all this jealousy and all this stuff, and it's just like this fucking nightmare. But when you break it down, you're going, actually, you know what? This is the area that I'm struggling in the most. Okay, example. So Zachary checked 9, so top of the charts, for number 4, which is the anger towards yourself, because his most overpowering experience with jealousy was self-hatred. He explained, I was judging myself to be a total loser who any woman would dump immediately if she had anyone else to date. And then it says, just saying it out loud made him realize how inaccurate his belief was. He currently had a successful long-term relationship with his partner, who had dated numerous other men over the years and never left him for any of them. And so he was kind of trying to understand why he felt so bad about himself, and then considered his childhood competition with his older brother. His brother excelled in sports, had lots of women pursuing him in high school, yada, yada, yada. Zach was shy, kind of goth geek, didn't have a girlfriend until he was 18, and felt really insecure about his sexual attractiveness. But since then, he's had very positive experiences with women and has had many women interested in relationships with him. So he's got plenty of this evidence, essentially, right? Like proof that his old script about being a loser was untrue. And so with that, he was able to work on his self-esteem and remind himself that he's not competing with his brother. And then he's got evidence working against that old belief or narrative. Another example, which I quite liked, talking about Alexis, the second component. So the second component was fear and sadness that we may not be able to have everything we want in this relationship and that we cannot control the situation. She checked 10 in both categories for number 2. So 10 being it's a large part of her jealousy, and it's extremely painful and debilitating when she experiences jealousy. She says, fear and sadness that we may not be able to have everything we want in this relationship and that we cannot control the situation. Freud really had my number. Her husband, Jason, tended to dismiss her requests for poly agreements, insisting on having complete freedom to do whatever he wanted in outside romantic relationships, no matter how much it hurt Alexis. She felt powerless, disrespected, and unloved. In couples counseling, I explained to Jason that he had confused an open marriage with being single. When you are single, you can sleep with anyone, spend as much time with anyone as you want, and have whatever types of relationships you want to have with as many lovers as you can handle. When you're in a committed relationship, however, you must collaborate with your partner or spouse to negotiate some guidelines for outside relationships. He eventually got it, and the boundaries are appropriate for the relationship, their poly relationship. And he limited the number of outside lovers to a maximum of 2 at any one time, and to spend no more than 3 nights a week away from home, which allowed Alexis to feel more comfortable with the compromise and found her jealousy subsiding, since she felt more in control of how things were unfolding. She felt more secure about having enough of her husband's time and attention. Do you think that people confuse being open with being single?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Like, I think you've even asked me that question of like, what would single Greg do like in this scenario? And I think I've said to you, like, but I'm not, you know, it's not single me that can just do whatever I want. Like you, I need to consider you, and I should be considering you because we're in a relationship together. So yeah, absolutely. I think that being in an open relationship isn't, you know, just like being single, because, you know, when people talk about being single, you talk to single people about being single, and they're like, oh, I don't have to consider anyone. I can just do what I want. I can book things and just take off on holidays or go away, like, and don't have to answer to anyone. It's like an open relationship isn't, you know, people will go, oh, it's like you're single and in a relationship at the same time. It's like you get some of the elements of someone who is single, but I would say more so it's I'm in a relationship, you know, than, and yeah. So I think that people do think you kind of, you know, people always say like, you know, you want your cake and eat it too, but yeah, I think that to do it in a healthy way, you have to consider each other. You know, like we've said from the start, it's like you're a team in this and it's something you're doing together. So I think everything sort of is something you need to work through together and not have complete, like, almost detachment to, you know, I don't know, you know, sharing that or making decisions together, or at least having to consider your partner in those scenarios.
Yeah, and I wonder how much people that do just go in with like a, well, this is how it operates. It just operates the way that I was single, are not sitting down and having those conversations. You know, I wonder if there's similarities between that and a don't ask, don't tell arrangement, where it's like, it's an open relationship, but without any of the communication or opportunity to be challenged and grow and learn a little bit more about each other and have a whole lot of hard conversations, essentially. So I wonder if that is part of it, or it, I mean, I assume that there's just a lot of assuming the rules, right, without actually writing them, just being like, oh, we'll just be open and we'll just behave however we want to behave, and one person's freaking out while the other person's like, freedom.
You know, like in that scenario, right, like someone, your partner's, you know, a 10 out of 10 in both of those aspects, you know, super stressed out, but it's like, yeah, agreeing to limit his nights out to 3 nights a week. Like, what was he doing before that, right?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
You know, if 3 nights a week is the negotiation of like, oh, I'll make sure that I'm not out and sleeping at other people's houses more than 3 nights a week, like, more than that is more than 50% of the week. So at that point, you're more single than you are in a relationship. So you know, are you actually kind of in a, maybe a solo poly type arrangement more so than you're actually in a poly relationship at that point? Mm. If you're spending more than half your week without your partner, yeah, I don't know. Yeah, it's just interesting that was almost the negotiation, was to, you know, have, you know, at least 50% of the week together, kind of thing. But yeah, I think that the thing with, you know, going into an open relationship, I think the biggest thing, people, you know, I've talked to people about this, about like, what does it take to kind of make it work, right? And it's like, I know people that have tried to do it with people and it hasn't worked out, and that usually leaves a bit of a bad taste in their mouth about what open relationships are about. But it's like, I think you have to come into it with knowing why you're doing it personally and as a couple. I think as in your relationship, need to have a really clear set of like, what are your values? What do you want from life together? And then to be able to continue through the thing as like your, you know, teammates, your partners, your, you know, whatever the right wording that you want to use is, but you have to realize like you're doing it together.
Mm.
And if you've got a solo mindset of like, oh, I'm just over here doing my own thing and I can do that, well, yeah, sure, I've got a girlfriend or a boyfriend or a, you know, partner or whatever, I think that's, you're probably more likely to, like, you know, you hear about people cheating in non-monogamy and stuff like that, where it's like, if you're kind of out there just kind of doing it for yourself and kind of thinking that like you don't have to answer to anyone in a way, or you don't owe anyone, you know, I suppose the courtesy and respect of saying like, hey, like, what do we agree to do and not agree? Like, what are the boundaries? How do I make sure I respect you? I imagine that's where people probably end up cheating in non-monogamy.
Yeah, I think so much of it depends on what the match is between the two people. And I think that I could have an exceptional open relationship with you and then meet someone hypothetically in another relationship and try to do non-monogamy and it totally not work, regardless of my skill or ability or experience, because that person has different set of beliefs, different values. We're compatible in different ways or not compatible in some ways. We've got totally different attachment history. And then even communication, right? Like some people's communication skills, you're just different. You're at different phases, different stages. So I think it's like, you can kind of argue for non-monogamy all you want or for monogamy. But I think ultimately it's like, what's the match like with you and the person that you're with? Because ultimately it doesn't matter how non-monogamous you might be, or non-monogamous, if they don't align some, you know, with the majority of those things, I just don't think it'll, I don't think it'll work. And so I don't know if there's really an argument for this structure being better than this structure. It's what are the two people actually, how do they link up? Is there a mismatch in something like communication or attachment? Because if those are missing, fucking good luck.
But I think all those things that you just talked about, like the person that's going to fuck up on those things in a non-monogamous relationship is going to fuck up in a monogamous relationship on it. Like, you know, all the things I talked about shared values, you know, good communication, you know, understanding why you're doing what you're doing, like you could apply them to any relationship structure. And it's like, if you're with someone that doesn't know how to be vulnerable and talk about their feelings or communicate with you when they're going through something or they need something, like all of the same stuff applies in any relationship style. The big difference, I think, in what, you know, when I meet people that are non-monogamous that I'm impressed about is like they've actually talked about the relationship style they're in. Whereas like you talk to generally people that are in monogamous relationships and it's like they've never had any discussions about like, hey, what do you want from this? Why are we doing this? Like, what are the ways we're going to do it? What are your boundaries? What do you like? All of those things that non-monogamy forces you to have the conversation about in order to actually have any chance of success. I think if people just, if you truly want monogamy and that's, you know, the thing that you've worked through, like, what do I really want? And that's what you want. And you want to talk to, like, you should talk through the same aspects to your partner, you know, ask the person you're dating, like, hey, do you want to be monogamous? And why is that? You know, because if they can't answer some of those basic questions or they're not willing to even have a discussion on that, it's like, I think you're starting out on really shaky footing in a way. So I think that that's the, you know, the same success criteria or the ways of being successful apply everywhere. But yeah, I think it's maybe just that non-monogamy generally makes people have the conversation with their partner about all of those things rather than just going in and holding on and hoping for the best that I think a lot of people do in monogamy.
Yeah, I agree. I think the idea of looking at a potential partner through the lens of who is that person and what can you create or talk about with them, rather than looking at it through the lens of I want monogamy with this person and we're just going to assume that we both follow the same rules and not ever talk about it. So it's like you can't argue for monogamy without having a discussion of like who is it and how have they figured out that why that dynamic works for them. You just reminded me of this Reddit that I don't know if I have it anymore, but it was a guy talking about how he's been dating this girl for 18 months. It was like a year and a half that he'd been dating her. And he was upset because he'd just found out that in the time that they'd been dating, she'd slept with four other guys. And when this happened,
she was like,
she was like, well, we never talked about being exclusive. You didn't ever ask me to be your girlfriend. And he's like, well, I would have been super pissed. Like, if I would have never done that, and I'm surprised that she did that, and were we not exclusive? And like, how was that? Do I let it slide? Did she cheat on me? Or did she not cheat on me? Like, trying to like define all this stuff. And I'm like, man, how have you gone a year and a half and never talked about what you want? This is,
but that's a perfect example that I think that's what a lot of people do, right? It's like they just fall into whatever the relationship is. And it's like, you know, usually it's like, oh, hey, like, do you want to be together? Or, hey, are you seeing anyone else? And it's like, you know, there's almost like implied, you know, for a lot of people, I don't think there is a question of like, hey, do you want to be exclusive with me? What does that mean for you? You know, what are those things? Like, I think a lot of times you hear those stories of like people breaking up because like someone got caught like liking other girls, you know, Instagram photos or DMing girls on Instagram. It's like, well, if you've never actually talked about like, hey, that's not that, I see that as cheating. I see that as a boundary of mine. Or, you know, is someone, some people just are doing those things and then going, Oh shit, okay. Well, that's a boundary of yours. Oh, I shouldn't have done that. I didn't know I wasn't allowed to follow other girls' Instagram pages, whatever. Like, talk to my ex-girlfriend still, like whatever the scenario is. I think there is so much just implied stuff that people fall into.
Yeah, I really liked that when we first got together. We asked tons of questions. And I think, maybe it was prompted by doing a lot of question decks and doing the 36 questions, all that stuff. But I remember talking to you about like all these like hypothetical scenarios. And it probably came in with the conversation of like, we're going to be open. So how do we do this? And so we talked about cheating. We talked about pregnancy. I asked you even in the last month what we would do if you got someone else pregnant and they wanted to keep it. So it was like just we have these conversations is just hypothetical. And I think, I think that if that is something that you want to have with a person that you're seeing or dating or someone that you're in a relationship with, you have to be able to answer that question, or your partner needs to be able to answer that question without trying to protect you and actually answer it honestly. I think that there'd be a lot of people who would say like, "Hey, would you ever cheat on me?" Oh, you sent me the question the other day on the ferry. Yes. Okay. So the challenge you ask your partner, the challenge would be, "Would you cheat on me for $1 billion?" And then see what they say. Greg was like, by the way, please cheat on me for $1 billion. That would set us up really well. I was like, I don't
It
know.
was a
I think
question.
I was like, I
I
don't
was just
know
going to
if,
explain what it was. So
yeah, you
it
can
was a
explain
Reddit
it in.
post. Yeah.
Okay, you explain it and then I'll talk.
Sure. So it was a Reddit post of same of a guy who asked his girlfriend, "Would you cheat on me for $1 billion?" Because I think there was something else that led to that question in some other scenario. I think it was like something to do with someone pooping on someone, I think was the leading question. And she's like, "Oh yeah, look, I'd probably do that," or "No, I wouldn't," whatever it was. And then he asked, "Would you cheat on me for $1 billion?" And she said yes. And then he was like ending the relationship over it was the post. And I'd sent it to Kate saying, or sent just a message to her saying, "Hey, would you cheat on me for $1 billion?"
To which I responded, if I essentially what in my brain, I'm like, well, it's not cheating. It's like potentially losing your trust and the security in our relationship. But ultimately, through having the conversation of, would you cheat on me for $1 billion? It felt like a loophole in the system because now I have consent to cheat on him. So is it really cheating if he kind of knows, but it could just happen at any point?
Just
But I
for
feel
clarity,
like.
you have consent to cheat on me for $1 billion.
Just for $1 billion.
Yeah,
That's the
nothing
only,
less.
that's the, yeah, okay. All right. That's the price. So any offers, just send them to me. Yeah, which it's just such a funny concept where someone can't even handle the conversation. Like the possibility of that, just not even being open to talking about it and being so upset that you're willing to break up with someone over a hypothetical scenario.
Or even just being able to joke about that, right? Like as a couple, you're in a long-term relationship, like you hear about us, that something like that coming up, right? And like your partner asks you, and then you can actually joke about it, like, and you just react to that stuff. It's like, look, most people are never going to be in the situation they're going to be offered $1 billion to cheat on their partner. So it's like it's almost such a ridiculous amount of money that it's not, no, it's never going to happen, right? But I'm sure that there is a like. My next question probably to if I was that guy would be, and my partner said yes to $1 billion, I go, what about 1 million? What would the number be? Because like you almost want to work your way down, right, to go, well, where's your limit? And because I just think that's an interesting thing. It's like, okay, is it $1,000? Is it $100? And if so, I don't know, maybe you end up talking about non-monogamy in general if someone's willing to do it for $100, but
I think people have the joke around hall passes, right? Like that's probably the common thing that people are comfortable joking about. But it's almost like how you have to take it beyond just the joke, like the off the cuff comment of like, oh, that fucking Margot Robbie would be my hall pass, or whoever you say is your hall pass. And it's like, people laugh about it, the likelihood of it ever happening, and the idea that that person would even want to fuck your partner is so low. I would love to find a story where it actually happened. I've never heard of someone actually being able to fuck their whole boss. But I think it's almost like that's an opportunity. That's an opportunity to be like, hey, if it actually happened, if I met my hall pass and they were like hitting on me and hinting that they wanted to go back to their hotel room or whatever this thing is, the scenario, what would happen? How would you feel? Is it an opportunity? If I actually did it, how would you react? Are you expecting me to decline them and be like, you know, all prim and proper? Like play that out, right?
Hmm. I heard a story not long ago of someone who'd asked their partner or had made a joke about their hall pass and like asked whether they could have a hall pass for a celebrity or something like that. And when she then said who hers was, it was someone that they knew. And it was like, I forget what the scenario was, but it was like, not her boss, but it was someone hot that it was actually within the possibility of them connecting kind of thing. It was something like either someone local or someone in one of their existing circles or something. And it was the same. He was on Reddit going, oh my God, I don't think I can handle this, knowing that she wants to fuck, you know, this person that is like almost seems like a real person versus the celebrity who's like this, you're never going to meet them. They're essentially like a, you know, AI character on the internet. But yeah, I thought that was quite interesting. Someone going, oh, my whole past is actually someone that it is possible that I, you know, that I could hook up with. It's like, same, like, okay, well, let's talk about that. But yeah, I just think in general, there's like, you know, we've talked about before, ever even asking like the question of like, oh, have you ever considered a threesome? Like, what do you think of monogamy? And like, if you can't even have those discussions in your relationship or to say to your partner, just ask about those ideas of what do you think of non-monogamy without them freaking out. And if they freak out at just the question, it's like, look, you've got a long time in life together and hard things are going to come up and hard conversations will have to happen. So I just think that should be like, I hate the whole red flag thing, right? But it's like, if your partner can't even talk about some of these subjects without some kind of grand reaction to what you're saying, like that in itself is a discussion that you need to have. Because if they can't even talk to you about something hard without freaking out, they've obviously got shit that they need to work out themselves, right? So
yeah, I wonder, like, the Reddit of the guy who was like, we've been dating for a year and a half and she cheated on me, but we were never exclusive, so I don't know what to do. He was saying that he thought that they were just kind of like, you know, building up and the conversation would happen organically. And I think people do the same thing with talking about sex, where there's like this romantic notion that it will happen naturally and organically and it'll be this spontaneous thing where both people are just perfectly aligned and they just match in every way and they both want the same thing and they have the same rules in their head of how things should work. And it's like, fucking no one has the same rules. Never assume that you're aligned. Like, and I think you have to remove that, this romantic idealization of meeting someone and not having to talk about how it's going to work. The same thing with sex, like meeting someone and feeling like if you talk about what they like or what they want, it's going to like rob the romance or rob the sexiness away. And it's like, no, like one, it's a conversation that's not the whole night. It's not like sex is replaced by having to talk about every single step. And it's something where it actually becomes, it's not organic in the beginning. It actually has to become organic towards the end. Like it's like the back end. You do all the hard yards early on and you build this understanding of each other. And then as you get to know each other more and more and more, it becomes more fluid and it becomes more organic. And it's just an expression of the knowledge that you've gained of that person from the beginning, rather than reactively trying to gain the knowledge, which I think is what so many people do. It's like we reactively have the what are we conversation. We reactively have the, okay, I guess I have to propose because she's starting to get mad. And then we reactively have the kids because it's getting close to like when she said that the deadline is. And then we reactively talk about sex because we've got a dead bedroom situation. So it's like, why not get ahead of that? Why not have those kind of like clunky, funny conversations where you actually sit down and you're like, hey, what do you like? What are you into? What's your thoughts on this? What's your opinion on that? I just think people have, it's just like this romanticized version of relationships and sex in general and what they've seen. I don't know. Is it from what people have seen in movies, stories? Is it fucking Disney? Are we all just like suffering from terrible Disney complexes? What is it?
I think just two things, and then one thing, and then I'll answer the question. Like on what you're talking about, one of the posts of Dr. Jana's that I really like is, and I always refer to it to people when on the subject is like, you should be starting your relationship on the premise that at some point one of you is going to want to fuck someone else, so have the conversation. Like from day one when you meet someone, right? Like maybe not day one, but right at the start, you know, when you first start seeing someone, it's obvious that it's evolving into a relationship of some sort. To the, hey, let's have a conversation about monogamy. What are your ideas? What are all of that stuff? Be like, hey, it's super common in relationships that infidelity occurs. Then there's a bunch of people that infidelity doesn't occur with that do experience desire for other people. You know, on top of that, I don't know what the percentage would be, but I'm going to say it's probably in the 90s that 90% of people, right? That's not real data. No one quote me. you know, experience desire at some point in a long-term relationship. So, why it should be more normal that you have that conversation than not? You know, having the conversation to say, "Hey, this is super common. What are we going to do when that happens? Is that something we just keep as a little secret? Do you want us, should we talk about that? Do you want to know about it? You know, how would you feel if that's you? Like, do you want to be able to tell me about it?" Like, I just think that in itself is such a change, and I'll use Jessica Fern's wording, like change in paradigm coming into a relationship to start from the position of this is what's real, and this is what, you know, is likely outcome for a relationship. So let's try and do it differently. Because then I think to come to you, then your question of like, what is it? It's like, I think it's two parts of that. It's like people wanting to avoid hard, number one, people not wanting to actually have that confronting conversation of like, hey, I know at some point during this, you might, you know, have desire for someone who isn't me. Can we talk about that? Like, that's uncomfortable. It's hard, right? But most hard things, you know, are good for us in the long term. But I also don't think it's ever, none of us learn that stuff, right? Like, no one taught me about sex. I had to figure that out for myself. No one modeled to me, told me, showed me, talked to me about how to have that conversation with a new partner. And hey, when you meet someone that you're interested in, do this. Like, it's only been through fucking it up a bunch of times and hurting people that I'm like, oh, wait, like, you know, this is how I need to conduct myself. And, you know, you hurt someone, you're like, oh shit, I didn't realize that was the wrong thing. It's like you learn by making the mistake. So I just think a lot of people haven't really learnt how to have those conversations. I think a lot of people probably haven't done the internal work to, because if you ask the question, you need to be able to answer yourself as well. It's like, because if you ask someone, like, hey, about desire, whatever, it's like the next thing that's going to happen is they're going to ask you, and then you need to be able to answer that. And I think that putting people in that place of vulnerability and sort of having to answer the hard question is difficult, right? And I think it comes out in sex as well, where, you know, people are asking, like, hey, what makes you come? Hey, what do you enjoy in bed? It's like if someone says something that you actually don't know how to do, or you don't know if you've got the ability or the capability to deliver on, that can be probably vulnerable as well, right? If someone says, well, I need you to do this thing, or this is what I really like, and you go, shit, I don't know what I'm doing enough to do that. So if you avoid asking, then there's not an expectation being set that then you don't feel like you're meeting. So people, I don't know, like I think some of that where it's easier just to avoid all of those things. It's easier to avoid the hard conversations. It's easier to avoid expectation and, you know, almost discomfort. And you see that in the ghosting culture and like all of these parts of our current dating culture where people just, it's easier just to disappear, right? Than to say to someone, hey, this has been really fun, but, you know, I'm seeing someone else now. Or hey, this has been really fun, but, you know, I'm not feeling this progress any further. Like, I think that there is just this piece in our culture where people go, oh no, that's hard. I'll lock that away in a box and I won't touch it.
I know you don't like the word radical, but radical honesty comes to mind. It's something that I feel like maybe you don't even need to put the radical in front of it, but you just have to be brutally honest, and really good at just saying how you feel or what you think. And you know, I really like the Stoic phrase "virtue over happiness," because I think, you know, we place such importance on love and happiness that we forget that we have to be fucking honest and we have to be super respectful and we have to have a shit ton of integrity. And that doesn't feel like love and happiness and light and rainbows. It actually feels really hard and it might be shameful or embarrassing, or you might feel scared, or you might feel like you're going to fail, or like these things that Freud talks about where you might have this fear of not being enough, or feeling like your rivals are going to win the love of your partner, or you might not be everything, you know, your relationship might not be giving you everything that you need or not giving everything your partner needs. So it's like you have to actually confront all of those things in order to get the good stuff, in order to ultimately build the relationship that you want and find that person. And I guess what everybody's doing in avoiding that conversation is winding up with people in relationships that aren't working. So yeah, it's like, what's the pain that you want to, what's the pain? Like which choice, which suffering would you prefer? The suffering of being in a shitty relationship for a really long period of time that you're monogamous and you've been together for ages, but how well is it functioning and how happy are you? Or the pain of having hard conversations early on and then knowing who you're with and knowing what you want and knowing that you've got the ability to speak freely and be vulnerable and actually express yourself.
Yeah, I think that's the lesson that I learned, right? Is like you go through all these scenarios where you don't speak up, you don't tell people what you want, trying to avoid hurting them. You know, the amount of times that was my story where I'm like, well, I don't want to tell this person completely how I feel because then I might hurt them, or I'll just avoid that, you know, little feeling of resentment or anger or whatever it is because I don't want to hurt their feelings. That compounds over time and then you end up causing the ultimate hurt. and you sort of end up then realizing if you've got good, you know, I'd say, you know, self-awareness around that, you realize that actually speaking up and you know, living by that virtue and your values and being truthful up front, you might end things early, right? Like you might speak up with someone 2 weeks into something and they go, look, that's just not for me. And you go, cool. Well, like you don't end up wasting 5 years before that thing becomes, you know, a big thing. And the desire for other people comes up and you go to your partner going, hey, can we now try and talk about this thing reactively? And it blows everything up. You're like, oh shit, if I just asked that question in the first 2 weeks and we had that conversation when feelings were not, you know, 5 years down the track, it felt like everything was at stake. And, you know, to back to the start of like those, you know, the four elements you talked about, like where almost those, that feeling of loss or the size of the loss and the grief, like, is 10 times what it would have been in week one, where it's probably easier to have that conversation with someone on a first date to be like, have you ever thought about non-monogamy? Or, hey, you know, have you ever felt desire in a relationship? Like, I think that's what we did really early on, was not really talk about it in our context of like how it is with us, but just externally of like talking about different scenarios and how would you react in this case? Or what have you done in this way? Where it's not about you as a couple, it's just your thoughts and beliefs about the world and back to the values thing. So I think that's where addressing some of that stuff up front, yeah, gets it out of the way when things are less at stake. But I also think it's sort of, yeah, like you say, you're seeing how someone reacts to those questions. And, you know, my story that I've told before on the podcast, but to anyone that sort of asks about our origin story, is like, I still, you know, that first weekend that we talked and then I went out on a date with someone and I caught myself out telling you, oh, I'd just been to see a friend. And then I ended up telling you, oh, hey, that was not true. I went and hooked up with someone and you responded without any reaction. You know, you just asked curious questions, wanted to know, you know, if I had fun, if I knew them, if I met them before, all of that stuff. Like, I think just took this massive weight off of like, oh, okay, I can be honest with you. And that, you know, I saw that non-reactivity side of you where you were just interested. And I think that that's, you know, I don't know, I suppose the best thing that people can do is get to that place where there shouldn't be anything you can't say to your partner. If they're truly the person that you want to spend your whole life with, go through all of the trials and tribulations and obstacles that life's going to throw at you, they should be someone that there's nothing that you need to hide from them. And if you feel like there's things that you can't bring up that you need to hide away in a dark closet from your partner, you need to really look and understand why. Like, is that because of them or is that because of you? Because it will come up eventually. It will escape the closet at some point. And if you haven't managed that well, you know, it'll end up blowing things up.
Yeah, I mean, I think ultimately that turns into some kind of resentment or some deep unhappiness. I think what has to come part and parcel with the honesty is people having the skill to be open to what's happening and not judge it or get defensive or angry in reaction to new information without first really understanding it and knowing why. And I think that has helped me a lot with you when, you know, I think this happened even recently where sometimes what comes up for me is when you're seeing someone multiple times. And I think you saw someone recently 2 weeks in a row. And that was part of what was freaking me out. And it just made me feel scared. And, you know, you were like, hey, maybe you should ask me about it because there was a reason why. And it wasn't because I was pursuing seeing them. It was just that it was these things and those things and they were going away. And she messaged me and this came up and it just worked out. And it wasn't like I was on the road to like, I want to establish a weekly Monday night hookup. And this is what's going to happen with this specific person because of these feelings I have. Whereas the story I'd made up in my head was like, oh my God, there's all these possibilities of why he could be pursuing someone multiple times and like twice, 2 weeks in a row. And like, maybe this is what he wants and I'm not enough. And maybe this carries on. I'm going to lose my time with him. Or, you know, it's like, it's always far worse in your imagination than it is in reality. And so, you know, I'm probably, one of my issues is I'm probably not very confrontational. And so hearing things like, hey, I just hooked up with someone, I'm like, okay, cool. Which is not going to say anything.
Cool.
But now I'm willing to inquire more and like we said earlier, like actually talk about it and be like, okay, well, tell me about that. And one of the things that I heard early on that helped me a lot with figuring out that conversation and figuring out how to behave when someone's being honest with you was to get to know that person with you removed from the equation. Get to know them in absence of you. And that just blew my whole head open because I was like, oh, everything that I think about Greg is in reference to me. Is somehow how it affects me and what happens to me and what's going on and what it means for me. And when it was like, hey, if you remove yourself from this person's world, what can you learn about them from this experience they've had or from what they're doing, what their wants and needs and desires are? And I just remember that being like I immediately felt incredibly selfish and then felt like I had this little like hack for thinking about how can I get to know Greg or how can I get to know anybody? And the trick was remove yourself from the equation and get to know them just as they are, as a person experiencing their world and life. And I think that was a really nice little breakthrough moment for me, which I don't always remember, but I try.
And that, like, I know we were talking about this earlier in a different context, right? It's like, if you're so busy, you know, almost you've got something to say in a conversation with someone and you've got your points and your story that you want to tell, it blocks you from listening, right? And it's like in not listening, you're not really hearing what the person's saying anyway. So you lose the opportunity for a more valuable conversation. And I think that is, you know, how people react in conversations generally. It's like they're already planning, like, what's the next thing I'm going to say? You know, and there's no space, right? Because it's like as soon as you finish, they're ready. And it's, you know, there's not that sort of listen, reflect, oh, okay, that's interesting. And it's like then follow up with a question instead of just, I want to tell you more stuff that I want to tell you kind of thing. I think comes up in the same way. It's like if you're reacting to your partner doing something, saying something, and you know, you jump into that. And I'm not talking about you, but I'll say, like, I'm making this about someone else, Robin.
Hypothetical.
You know, if you jumping straight to reaction because you're flooded by emotion, you know, it stops that opportunity and blocks the opportunity to get to know them, right? And I know that's what you're saying, like, and I think that's like the Gottman stuff that I've done. It's like, you know, if you notice that your partner's flooded, you go, hey, let's stop, you know, step back and come back once that flooding subsided, because you're not going to actually hear anything they say because you're just reacting to their thing. Because, yeah, like I said to you the other week, like in some of those moments, you know, the reaction to, like, you've seen them twice, oh my God, what does this mean? Like, it's instead of saying, like, hey, like, this is someone you've seen now twice in a row or twice in a short period of time. Like, you know, what, like, you know, is there something you're feeling about them? Is there something that, like, what's got you interested in them? Or, you know, whatever that is, like, the question, the conversation that then comes from that, you know, it's an opportunity to connect and learn about your partner, and, like, you know, opens the door to, like, if it is something where they're like, oh yeah, actually, like, I really like this about them, or just, oh, it was convenient, they were free, so it worked out well. You know, either one of those things is going to be an opportunity to learn and connect together.
Yeah, and maybe the skill is in learning how to ask follow-up questions, which I remember that was one of the things that I really liked about talking with you in our first week of meeting, where I just remember being like, oh, he listens, like he listens. And the indicator of that was that you weren't in a rush to talk. You're quite calculated when you did. And I think that, you know, it's, I think a lot of people expect to, you know, read books and listen to podcasts and think on these things. And I'm just as much of a, you know, victim of this as well, but is a skill that has to be practiced, and it usually won't happen in the moment that you need it. It has to happen elsewhere before you can use it in that critical moment of, you know, reconnecting after a date, or your partner goes on two dates with the same person in 1 week or 2 weeks, whatever it might be. And I think suddenly figuring, being like, I'm going to actively listen and get curious, it's like, that's probably the last thing that you'll figure out. So maybe the skill is in other conversations with friends, learning how to listen, and instead of giving your opinion, saying things like, oh, say more about that thing, or, oh, tell me about, like, a little bit more detail of that thing that you mentioned, or what was that like? Just figuring out, like, how do you ask, how do you get more out of someone? Like, how do you hold your opinion back? How do you hold back your own story, whatever reason it is, to empathize with them, to share something that was just as crazy as their story was, to one-up them, whatever it is that drives you to react, to be defensive, or to explain something that you think is valuable information, whatever it is that you feel like you're contributing to the conversation. One, I challenge you to consider why you think it's so valuable. That was something that one of my mentors told me when we were doing, I think I was presenting in front of people, and they were like, hey, when you answer or say things, just question yourself about why you think it's so valuable. And I was like, oh, okay, thanks. And so that really caught me off guard. I was like, I really do think that what I say is super valuable. And it may not necessarily be to fucking anyone except for me, because I think I'm so great. So I think that that was one of the things that I took away from, hey, in conversations, when you want to respond, it's usually because you think what you say is so valuable. And it's like, check that. And then figure out what can you ask instead of having a statement or a reaction or response. It's like, what can you ask to get out of them? And I actually don't think I'm very good at that. I think I get too much. I get excited to talk, and I get hyped up, and I get excited with people. And I also don't like awkward silences. I'm really bad at sitting silently. So I am really quick to open my mouth and fill a silence. And even one of our friends, we had to pick up some people that we didn't know from an airport to go to this retreat that we did. And she was like, Kate, you need to be there with me because you're so good at small talk. And I was like, oh, I'm all at once feeling like a little bit outraged and like it's a compliment, but not. It's like, oh no, that's okay. Yeah, I can do that. Sure. Totally fine.
I really like Esther's prompt on, like, and I know I use it now, but just saying say more.
Say more. Yeah. I use it, and I think, like, it's because you use it.
Yeah. I just think it's a really, you know, if someone says like, oh yeah, I was just feeling this, you're like, just a really simple prompt, just saying say more. Like, makes people go, oh, okay, like, I'll expand on it, right? Like, because it's like, they'll say, like, whatever they're saying, but you're not saying, well, tell me more about that thing. Or, like, just by saying, say more, it just opens up almost this open door of, like, them going, okay, well, okay, I'll just say more stuff, right? Like, about that thing. And so people will then either expand on their idea, they'll re-clarify it in a different way. I just think it's a good way of, like, almost, like, even if all they do is re-clarify what they were saying, it's a good way of almost forcing a bit of a pause, because you've heard them once, they either say it again or they expand on it. That gives you time to really go, okay, like listen, think through. So I think that's really handy. The other thing that I was going to say as well is that just asking someone to re-clarify what they've said. Like I notice that I do it a lot with work. People will say something and I'll say I'll just say to them, like, I didn't quite get that. Or, hey, can you just re-clarify that again so I make sure I understand you and what you're saying? And I think that works really well. I think the other one that I use as well is like, same thing again, in a work sense, but there's a book that I've read called The Advice Trap. And I really liked one of the questions in that he sort of uses in his structure was, what's the real challenge here for you, is the way that he words it. And so I think even questions like that, whether it's the exact same thing, right? Someone tells you about the problem, a problem they're having, instead of feeling like, oh, I need to respond to give you my advice on that thing. Even just asking a question like that of like, and why is that challenging for you? Like, and what is the real challenge you're feeling with it? Same thing again, gets people just to, you're turning it back to them. They're like re-clarifying, they're answering. I just think some of those things can really just make people kind of expand what they're saying or go deeper into conversations with you and tell you more about how they're feeling on something. And then last thing I'll say on that, I saw it was like a meme or something the other day or just like a post on Instagram about when someone responds with advice, it's not them giving advice, it's their younger self giving advice to themselves kind of thing. Like it was like, that's them telling you, they're telling you what they wish they heard when they were younger kind of thing. And I just thought that was kind of an interesting thing as well, right? Because I think that's sometimes the advice that you get from people is like based on their trauma, based on their life and the challenges that they've faced, they then cast that on you of like, you know, if they've been cheated on, they've been hurt. Like we all know those stories and, you know, that where it's like if your partner has, you know, there's been infidelity in a relationship, the person that reacts going like, dump them, get rid of them, you know, never speak to them again, delete their number, ghost them. Like, it's like, they're probably someone that's been through that themselves, right?
Every girl ever.
Yeah. But it's like, they've got such a
strong reaction. It's like girl code though, almost.
Girl code and every Reddit post ever on infidelity. But instead of saying, you know, I think there's some interesting reflection and questions on what was happening in the relationship. What was it like leading up to when it happened? It's like all of that context, I think, is interesting, if not, but just to learn more about what happened before you respond to it.
Yeah, I like that. So we've got say more, say it again. And what was,
Like, what's the real challenge? Or why is that a challenging thing for you? Or some version of that, right? When he talks about that question, Michael Bungay Steiner is his name. He's got two books out that are really great that I refer people to. But the way he asks the question is, what's the real challenge here for you? And he explains that question. He's not saying, well, what's the real challenge? And it's very much in like professional work sense, but I think it can apply in normal situation, like outside of work as well. But the for you part, he emphasizes as really important, because if you just say, well, what's the challenge, people will talk about things and other stuff, right? But if you say, what's the challenge here for you, then it turns to them internal, to like, well, why am I finding this scenario challenging? Like, what is it about this that is a challenge for me, is kind of the intent of the question.
The thing that happens when you start asking more questions, and this is something that I noticed because it's so obvious when you talk to people online with online dating, is you really quickly know who can have interesting conversation, who can't, because you'll end up being the only person asking questions and they won't ask any back. And that immediately is like I can't hang out with this person. They're probably going to be really boring or difficult to talk to. I wanted to like build on what you were saying around like expanding. So I have a degree in film.
Can I, just before you move on, can I go back to just something I listened to Jordan Peterson during the week, and he said some really interesting stuff about small talk, right? And I think just to, I'll make a point quickly on this, but he talked about, like, you know how everyone in online dating like talks about small talk and like, oh, it's so painful when people say like, hey, how are you? Or like, you know, just those sort of questions instead of jumping straight to like really deep questions. Jordan Peterson was saying, like, small talk has a place in social situations, right? It's really important that he said, like, if you go up to someone at a party and just walk straight up and be like, hey, tell me your deepest fear, they're going to be like, whoa, like, you know, that's too abrasive, right? And so he was saying that, like, you know, we small talk has this purpose of, like, you ask a basic question. If someone then can respond, you know, to that basic question in an interesting way, you'll elevate the conversation. And then it'll go to, like, the next thing of, like, okay, well, tell me more about yourself. And then it's like, if someone then responds to that in an interesting way, it's like all of a sudden you'll be talking about what your greatest fear in life is. But all of these little questions are kind of progressive building to sort of, you know, you're bouncing back with someone to go, small question, interesting response, cool, let's elevate to make see whether they're capable of having a better conversation. And I just thought it was a really interesting thing. People always talk about, like, online dating, and, like, sometimes I will ask someone, like, hey, you know, what's been the highlight of your week? And if someone just gives some, like, redundant, boring, like, I don't know, went to work.
The sun was shining.
Like, yeah, like, and it's like, okay, like, this conversation isn't going to be interesting if you can't even answer a highlight about your whole week or something like that. So, yeah, I think it was just an interesting point about kind of small talks sort of almost role in conversation and connection with people, that, you know, you have to pass those initial tests, right? And, like, online dating is the perfect example of that. Is like, if you ask someone a really basic question and they can't even respond to that, the chances of them having some kind of interesting conversation is pretty low. So anyway, yeah, I just thought it was an interesting little thing.
With conversation online, so a couple of things that I think are important is, like you said, the small talk has a place, and you can't jump in and like expect someone to answer you truthfully and be vulnerable without having said anything. And I also think that you can't expect people to answer deep questions without sharing things about yourself. And that's what I tend to do when I'm talking to people. If they ask me small talky kind of questions, and as the conversation progresses, I will share details to give them something to bounce off. And this is even reflected in how you set up your profile. So everything you write in your bio is not for you to have some kind of, you know, impression upon other people of who you are. It's to give someone else material. Someone else is going to have something to bounce off, to discuss with you, to feel like they connect with you, to feel like they're similar, to feel like they get some kind of insight into you in a way that they can actually feel like, you know, in the same way that I was talking about, you consider people in an equation with you and how, what your relationship is with them rather than them on their own. And so that's exactly what happens with dating. It's like when you look at a profile, you're reading it as how it relates to you. And so it's like, put information on your profile that gives people material and use that. Mm. And in conversation, so there are two directions that conversations go. And this is what I learned from school. My degree is in film, but I studied performing arts for the majority of my degree. And I put it to good use now. And I spent a lot of time doing theater and improv and all of that good stuff. And one of the really interesting things that you learn in improv is this idea of the direction of the conversation. Are you advancing or are you expanding? And typically, we all like to advance. So that's what catches you out being very surface level in conversation, because you'll ask a question, someone will respond, they'll ask you the question back, you'll respond, and you'll ask a new question about a new topic or a new thing, or you'll just advance, and you'll advance and advance and advance until you've covered all the topics, you've asked all the questions, and now you know each other. And then at the next date or at the next meeting, you don't ask those questions again because you've covered that ground. And that's the crazy thing. It's like people have one conversation that's deep about their history or their relationships or whatever, and they never revisit that. And it's like, man, you barely know that person. And in fact, I remember talking to you and feeling like I was like, I've forgotten things. I want to have this conversation all over again 2 weeks into hanging out with you because I don't remember what we talked about back then. So it's like you got to consider about how much are you spending advancing a conversation versus expanding, because expanding requires you to pull something out or for you to share more in response to a question. And so this was something that Matthew Hussey, who is kind of like he speaks to women about dating and relationships. And so he's very much, some of his advice can feel a little, not gimmicky, but a little bit, it's like, he's a bit of like a pickup kind of guy sometimes, But he usually has a message that is actually sincere and genuine, and I like it. And one of his little like tips was on like how to message people on dating apps. And it was exactly that. It was, hey, if someone says, hey, how's your day going? Rather than going, it's good. How's your going? How's yours going? Be like, oh, it's been pretty good. You know, I went for a walk and I got caught in the rain and I've just gotten home and I'm freaking drenched. But thank God that it's like, you know, like I've got the fire on or whatever the story is, or like my sister's here, so she's helping me wrestle with the dog. It's been a bit of a day. How's your day going? And it's like, it's surface level. It's fine. It's lighthearted. You can throw some information in there that's like, it's just easygoing and it doesn't have to be very deep, but it just allows you to expand. And then you can take that to the next level whenever you want. So when someone asks you about relationships or someone asks you about how's your dating going, and you can expand rather than give a single sentence, which it's easier to do if you're doing a quick conversation online. I think that's the difference between speaking online and in person. Maybe it happens in person as well, but it's like, hey, be conscious of, are you advancing too quickly? Are you trying to advance the conversation when you haven't expanded and there's an opportunity there to say more, tell me about that thing, or like, give me the highlight. That's not the highlight. Give me the real highlight. You know, it's like, expect more from people because they've got more. It's just that, you know, I don't think we practice conversation as a skill. It's just like, we're just trying to get on with it and try and check the boxes in a way. Just try not to be, it's almost like we're so focused on impressing someone else that we don't actually think about, like, what do I want to learn about this person? You know, it's like, I'm so focused on making sure someone likes me, especially in a dating scenario, that I don't even consider if I like them. And it's like, that's the trap. And that's when people end up in this on Reddit posting being like, I'm totally in love with this person, except for this thing that makes us totally incompatible. You're like, okay, maybe you're really focused on how you want them to feel about you and your feelings and not actually what it is that you need from a partner.
But I think one of the things that, like, to expand on what you just said, like, what you write in your dating bio, in the same way that someone tells you about their day in that more expansive way, it's the same principle, right? Because, like, when I ask someone, what was the highlight of your week? I don't actually care about, you know, not that I don't care. It's like, it's not really the response of the highlight of their week that I'm like, oh, great, that's cool. Like, it's what they give you in response to that. That then you can be like, cool, I know one thing that, like, if someone answers that in a expansive way, like you were talking about, like Michael Hussey talks about, someone's giving you what they're passionate about, what they care about, right? If they answer that in an interesting way, they're saying, here's the thing that really lit me up and was my absolute highlight of my whole week. It was, I did this thing. I went to the gym and I hit a PR, or, oh, I saw my sister that I haven't seen in a month and we went for a walk along the beach. It's like, cool. Like, that gives you stuff to then go, tell me about that. Tell me about that thing. And it's like, I think that's where people miss those opportunities, right? Like, if someone says, what was the highlight of your week? And you've got this pessimistic view of like, oh, this is just a small talk question. Then you're shutting down that opportunity for someone else to actually, you know, give an interesting response. And if you answer that in a proper way and go, what was my highlight? Okay, well, here's an expansive answer to that. And if someone answers that in a shit boring way, then yeah, sure, cut the conversation off, right? And go, well, hang on, I just told you about this thing that really lit me up with my week, something I'm really proud of. And you went, sounds good. Here's the thing to my week, right? Like, if someone just skips over that detail and, like you say, just advances the conversation, doesn't do anything with it, I think it probably says a lot about, you know, where the conversation's going. Thing that also reminded me of when you're speaking about that, there was a guy I heard on a podcast a long time ago that he made this like plan. I think he's written a book on it or something. He went on 365 first dates in a year was his like goal that he set for himself. And when the podcast I was listening to, when he got asked, like, what was the biggest thing you learned from, you know, going on 365 first dates? Because to go on 365 first dates, he also said that he had a lot of like second dates and third dates within that as well. He and a lot of people you need to talk to in order to do that. So he said the biggest thing that he learned from conversations on online dating was to not always answer a question, not always in your response put another question. And I really like that as well, because if every time you respond to something, you give them a question to advance the conversation off, instead of actually not including a question, then their only option, if they're actually good at having conversation, is to expand off what you've just said, or to think of an interesting question to ask you. And I think that's a really interesting almost test, because he said he learned that from, he would get to first dates with people and realize they didn't have the ability to carry a conversation forward, that he was the only one either expanding or advancing, to use the same language you're using. So I think that's another interesting thing as well, to go, well, if you, in some of those conversations with people, you actually just go, here, this was, you know, you answer the question, this was the highlight to my week. And then don't say, what was the highlight of your week at the end of that? Or how about you? The only thing that person can do, if you've answered, you know, your highlight in an interesting way, is to then try and pull something from what was your highlight, or have some sort of, you know, follow-up question of like, and why is that, you know, interesting to you? Whatever the example is, right? So yeah, I just thought that was another little thing.
Yeah, I like that. And I'm now thinking if I do that, because I ask so many questions. Yeah. Yeah.
It's interesting when you start to do it with people, because I do it intentionally with people. This was a couple of years ago now. And sometimes if I feel like someone, if that's like, if a conversation's kind of dry, I'll do that. And the amount of times that the conversation just drops dead. And I'm like, cool, all right. I know everything I need to know about you. We're not going to click, right? So.
I think a lot of people would feel like this is what happens with every conversation online. Like, I know sometimes I can feel like that with dating online. And the interesting thing is that I compare that with the experience that I had with the speed dating that I went to. And it was like so painfully obvious who could have interesting conversation based on the things that we had a mutual interest in. And that allowed the conversation to go to different areas. So someone mentioned Brené Brown to me, and someone mentioned some other random stuff. So there were probably two people there that I was like, oh, I actually had an interesting conversation. And then obviously there were six other people that I was like, this is deathly painful. But I think it becomes quite interesting when you do it in person. The struggle is that online doesn't necessarily give you that same ability to figure out, like, quite obviously who's able to do that and who's not. I feel like everybody's a little bit lazy online, maybe. What would you say to someone who feels like, but every conversation is shitty online and everybody's like that?
I don't know. Like, you know, there's the side of me that's maybe realistic. Like, I know, I think it can be tough in online dating world. And I think, look, if the last 3 years of hearing about both your dating adventures and other women through this whole thing is like, I think it's harder
Greg,
for women.
Greg
right?
has a lot of women complaining about dating. He hears it from everyone at the gym. And then from what I can gather, the lot of the conversations that, well, I'm blaming you. You like to talk about relationships. And so girls are like, I'm going to open up about relationships with you. And then they talk about all the shit that's happening.
Yeah. And it's like, so like, I think that is harder, even based off for you. Like, you've said that guys don't really ask you any questions about our relationship. Right. And it's like, just based off that, you go, okay, well, like, I'm sure it's hard. You know, I'm sure there's a bunch of guys out there that, you know, aren't very good at having conversations, but like, there's also, from what I gather, an abundance of guys for girls to choose from, right? Like, you know, the amount I've seen girls screenshots of, like, they join a dating app and 24 hours later, they've got 500, you know, likes. It's like, so you've actually kind of got an abundance of guys, and the quicker you can filter through which of them are worth wasting your time on, right? You know, the more that you, you know, coming into it, instead of going, well, oh shit, like, this is just going to be the same old thing, so I'll give a boring dead answer on my first response, say something really interesting. You know, if you say something interesting on your first message and they respond with nothing interesting in response, you go, okay, cool, like, let's end the conversation, thanks for your time, see you later. You know, almost see how quickly you can filter those people out. And I think if you go in, I've had people that, you know, almost give these like really boring answers, and it's like, if they just gave some kind of more interesting, like, and I think they're probably coming in with quite a pessimistic view on, like, I'm just another dude that's going to give them shitty small talk responses, so they put zero effort in because they're talking to another 20 guys in the same way, instead of actually going, okay, well, these, you know, 10 of these other guys are putting zero effort into their responses, oh, these over here are actually giving some interesting responses. I don't know. Like, I'm not a girl, so I don't know what girl Tinder is like when you're talking to people. But I think just the quicker you can maybe filter some of those people out, the better.
Yeah, and I think it kind of does turn into that, right? It's like, rather than getting pissed off with just the reality of online dating, it's like, hey, figure out how to pick people, and just, it's a sport. It's a dance. It's just part of it a little bit. And I also think, you know, I like to try to meet people in person as soon as possible. I think that part of talking to people online is being, it's almost like expediency and that whole process of like, hey, match, talk straight away. Don't fucking wait. Don't be waiting for them to send them a first message. Like, message people first, have a couple of like interesting back and forths, say a joke, you know, test out if they can be easily offended, and then be like, hey, let's get coffee. Let's get a drink. Yeah. And just like set something up early. I think that can be a really easy way to mitigate some of the pain of talking to people online for a long time. Like, I've been talking to Greg about someone that I've been talking to, and we've been talking for ages. We eventually met up for coffee. So I was kind of holding on to hope that, like, okay, we did catch up and he didn't just disappear and kind of it didn't fizzle out. So I was like, okay, maybe something will work out. But he's been someone who every time I've asked to lock down a time to meet again has kind of evaded it or ignored it, but then continued to message me a lot. And I've just gotten to a point where I'm like, hey, I don't want to do all this back and forth messaging. Let me know what your availability is. I'll let you know what mine is, and we can plan to meet up. That's what I'm looking for, kind of thing. And I haven't heard from him. So it's like, I think you have to be willing to, you know, as frustrated as I have been, and over these past few weeks, I've been like, oh, this guy, like, I'm trying to put in the effort. And it's just like, you know, I go back and forth between like, I'm not going to put any effort in. I'm just going to, you know, pull the pin on this early, or no, I need to try. But this one, I was like, no, I'll try. Like, he seems nice, and I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt. But now I've just laid down the law, because it's just like, hey, you've got to draw the line somewhere. And this is kind of exposing him in a way, which is good. You know, like, it's exactly what I wanted it to do. Even though it means that I might not meet up with him again, it's like, no, it's done exactly what I needed it to do. And it's put a pretty clear line in the sand of like where he has to meet me. And if he's not willing to do that, then that's fine. It's just that now I don't have to waste my time talking to someone back and forth. Yeah.
And because you have to look at that run and go, well, even if now he went, okay, yeah, I'll meet up with you, you know, you have to, I think, look at like all of those behaviors and go, is that going to be someone that ultimately, like, in bed, what's the effort going to be like? What's the, you know, what is it that they're in it for? If it's like, they haven't been like, hey, you're interesting, let's meet up. Like, you know, I think that there is sort of a degree where it's like, look, if they aren't interested, they aren't interested, and they're not kind of invested. And I'm sure that carries through to, you know, sex as well.
Yeah, it's like that. I've heard that saying thrown around where it's like, if they like you, you'll know.
Yeah.
It's like, if you're confused, you know, that's your answer. Yeah. Like, if you're confused, they're not interested. It's not like that. You're confused and they might be interested. It's like, no, if you're confused, they're not, you'll know. And I think it goes for, you know, casual dating as well. And we've discussed this in previous episodes where, like, you can have standards for dating. They might not be the same as what your standards would be for a relationship, but it's okay to not fuck around and waste your time and act like you're not worthy of a certain level of respect and communication. Like, I think that will only set you up for more suffering ultimately, right? And make the process potentially more painful. Okay, cool. Is there anything else you'd like to add, Mr. Wolf?
No, I think that's good. We've been talking for a long time.
I know. We did well. We cover a lot of ground when you and I get together and chat. Thank you for listening, everybody. I hope you have a fucking excellent end of 2023, and we will see you guys in 2024.
Thanks, everyone. Happy New Year.